Anne Murray, Brinson, Elstop, Teresa, and Bonnie Coffey, Francis Walter, for the petitioner, Matthew P. Belligan, senior assistant attorney general, for the court.
You may proceed.
I'm sorry?
You may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court, I am Parissa Dehoney Tafti for Winston Scott, and I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, please.
Five?
Yes. Science proves Mr. Scott is innocent. We know that because one person committed this rape. He ejaculated, he left his semen behind, inside of the survivor's body, and on the jeans the survivor wore immediately after the attack. The sperm on the jeans...
How do we know that last point?
We know it for two reasons, Justice Kelsey, because the first is Detective Wilkins, in the context of speaking to the victim in his report, says that he collected the clothing she wore immediately after the attack and bagged and tagged all of the items he collected. He's confirmed that that is what happened, given that he did not call the ID techs until after he'd done that and after he'd taken her to the hospital for her examination.
Was her DNA in that sample?
The DFS attributed three of the alleles that were found to the survivor.
Counsel, pull that microphone just a little bit closer to you.
Closer. I am somewhat soft-spoken.
Yes, you are. But we're going to fix it.
So you think if a jury had heard that, having rejected his alibi and having heard the witnesses, the complaining witnesses' identification of the testimony, that they would have said, well, as long as she put on clothes later and it doesn't include the defendant's DNA, then he must be innocent.
The answer to that question is yes, because the sperm on the jeans must be either from the perpetrator or from her sole sexual partner. And what we know is that when she went for the examination, Dr. Enos testified that the semen that was found inside of her body tested positive for acid phosphatase, and he timed it within 5 hours of the exam, which is just at the time of the rape. Now, because semen is liquid and liquid drains down, it would have drained down once she got up and put on the jeans from the bed. And significantly, there is no semen on the bed. It's the only place.
Okay, but didn't she say she did put on the jeans after the rape, but she said she may have pulled them from the dirty clothes. She wasn't sure. She may have or may not have been with someone else during that time, depending on what stage of the relationship she was in with her boyfriend. And so how do we know the timing of the stain on the jeans being deposited?
We know the timing of the stain of the jeans because of the positive acid phosphatase test. Had the jeans been... we know that that semen deposit got to the jeans after the last wash. So it was a fresh deposit because of that. And the results are concordant with the vaginal swab results. And if there had been any other partner and the jeans had been soiled from any other sexual activity, the sperm fraction would have been a mixture. And the sperm fraction is without any doubt, and the Commonwealth cannot contest, and DFS has told us that it is a single source profile, and it's a redundant profile on both of the jeans cuttings. So there's no question that this is one person, and only one person had the opportunity, unfortunately, to deposit the semen on these jeans.
There's some suggestion that, if I understand the Commonwealth's position, that she had a roommate, and could it have been the roommate's jeans that she put on?
She said very clearly that she and her roommate did not share rooms and did not share laundry bins, and that she put on the jeans before she left her bedroom. So there's no way she could have gotten her roommate's jeans. Moreover, the concerns of the court that might have about the additional alleles in the non-sperm fraction, I think are abated by the fact that this court has granted two writs of actual innocence in the case of Gary Diamond and in the case of Calvin Cunningham, where in Calvin Cunningham, there were two stray alleles in the sperm fraction. And that's important because the sperm fraction identifies who the perpetrator is. It identifies the male without question. And in Diamond, one of the cuttings of the pants also indicated not just unexplained alleles, but so many unexplained alleles that there was it was called a mixture. And so what this court has granted the writ on the higher standard of proof when there was a mixture in the sperm fraction and when there was stray alleles in the sperm fraction. And what we have here is a much stronger case and a lower standard of proof because the sperm is in an intimate area, unlike Diamond, which was on the thigh. And
in Diamond, was there an alibi that was rejected by the jury?
There was.
In Diamond, was there any sort of recantation of any kind by the victim?
There was not.
So what is the distinguishing factor, if any? None, I take it, from your perspective.
We actually think this is a stronger case than Diamond because of the single source sperm. And the stronger facts with the lower standard, it's hard to imagine that the court wouldn't grant on that. But I'd also like to talk about a case, and it's the flip side of this. And it's a case that came out of old case testing. And it was Thomas Pope was convicted of rape and murder. And he was convicted on an 8 loci profile that contained a stray allele that did not match him, and it did not match the victim in the case. And he was convicted beyond a reasonable doubt, and the Court of Appeals, with Justice Kelsey sitting on the panel, confirmed that decision. This case flipped completely over. And if this evidence, this kind of evidence from old case testing with a clean sperm result and a stray allele meets this highest standard of proof that we have in our legal system, it's hard to imagine, again, how this could not, on an intermediate and a much lower standard of proof, result in an exoneration.
There's no question on chain of custody, right, of contamination or anything like that?
No, there's not. We know that Detective Wilkins collected the genes. He says it in the context of speaking with the victim, and the plain language reading of that is that he collected it from the victim. And then in terms of, he sent it to the lab, and it went back and forth because the Commonwealth initially didn't like the ABO typing results, and so they resent it to the lab for additional testing. A very likely source of the stray alleles is the fact that we know that somebody, most likely Mary Jane Burton, touched the genes in order to make the cuttings and scotch tape them to the file. And the contamination, if there is any, is not in this. There is no contamination in the sperm fraction, which is the part that identifies the perpetrator. And
In other words, I was getting at a more basic point, which is unlike something sitting in an unsecured hospital file, and we, you know, over a very extended period of time, this was in the DFS in the Commonwealth, which typically takes some care in securing it and so on.
That is exactly correct. The first time it was sent to the lab, Mary Jane Burton took the cuttings from the swabs and from the central part of the genes that had the most dense discernible semen stain with the most amount, and she said many intact sperm and the strong positive acid phosphatase result. When it went back to Detective Wilkins and then it went back to the lab, and she took the second cutting of genes. And there was no question that chain of custody is locked in. And then there's a presumption once items get to DFS that those are cared for appropriately.
I ask you to hypothesize for a moment that you're in trial right now,
mm-hmm.
that the prosecution acknowledges these genes exist, that they've been tested, the boyfriend's DNA is not on it, and the defendant's DNA is not on it. And the prosecutor says to the jury, well, there's a very strong possibility that the DNA on the genes existed before the rape, and you have an opportunity to tell the jury why that's not true, how would you succinctly respond to the argument?
I would say that had the semen on the jeans before the rape, there would have been a mixture in the sperm fraction because the semen that was deposited within 5 hours of her exam had to drain down when she stood up. And I would say that the positive acid phosphatase result and the many intact sperm also indicate that it was a recent deposit, not since any previous washing.
Under your expert testimony, how recent?
I'm sorry?
How recent?
If she had
relations a day earlier, for example, with another boyfriend that's never been disclosed, would the science exclude that possibility?
It would have to be a mixture. So if that semen stain had been put on the jeans the day before, which there's no evidence of that in the record, and then she put the jeans on again after the rape, that sperm fraction would be a mixture. It would not be a single source profile. And there's no reason for her to lie about who her partner was, and unless the Commonwealth is suggesting that she's wrong about everything except for her identification, she's wrong about the fact that she put on jeans, and she's wrong about the fact that she had only one consensual partner who's been eliminated from every piece of DNA evidence, there's only one logical conclusion, and that's that neither her boyfriend and neither Mr. Scott deposited the semen, and so it has to be the perpetrator. And we know who that perpetrator is by his DNA identity. We just don't know what his name is.
So the linchpin of your argument to the jury is there's nothing you've heard from beginning to end of this trial that suggests another boyfriend or another anything.
Correct.
But had she, just to tease this out to see how far your logic goes, suppose she had said that. But she said, look, I have multiple partners, really none of your business, but I was raped by this one guy. And yeah, you can pull something out of my shelf or whatever, but suppose she'd said something like that. How would you respond to that?
The sperm fraction would have had to have been a mixture. If the semen was from any other person and she put on those jeans the morning of, and there's no reason to believe she didn't, and every reason to believe she did, that sperm fraction would not be a single source profile.
Would you like to save the remainder of your time?
I would love to. Thank you, Chief Justice.
Please, Court. Good morning. My name is Matthew Dolgan, Senior Assistant Attorney General here for the respondent in this petition. While petitioner has asserted there's no question of chain of custody, that there certainly is a question of chain of custody at trial. In fact, the prosecution objected specifically that Scott at trial had not established the full chain of custody and that the serology test should not be admissible in the absence of the chain of custody. It was only after some argument, it was discussion with the court and counsel, that there was an agreement that he would not raise that objection to the admission of one of the serological results if the defendant would likewise not object to the admission of the second serological result, because of the Commonwealth argument that since they were contrary results and inconclusive, they should have no weight. And if they wanted to show the results to the jury, they should see both and realize that they were inconclusive. But there was no chain of custody, and the testimony at trial was that Investigator Wilkins was past the genes when he came to the house. In fact, the Commonwealth was willing to stipulate at trial was that the genes in question are the victim's and were taken from her apartment that morning. There was no stipulation that those were the genes that she wore that night. There was no evidence that there were genes she wore that night. There was no other evidence supporting an inference.
Well, they came from the apartment, right? And according to the victim, you know, she kept her laundry separate from her. I mean, I know sometimes roommates share clothes, whatever, but apparently that wasn't the case. So is the Commonwealth's theory that there may have been a mistake and the police seized the jeans from the roommate's laundry pile?
No.
And they happened to have fresh semen on them?
No, it was the Commonwealth's position at trial. I stipulated they were the victims, but they were not necessarily the genes that she put on the night of the rape.
Okay, so then what that leaves us with is the victim lied about having a single sexual partner, right? Is that the only way we account for this?
Well, the victim's statement in 2017, as was noted earlier, was that depending on the stage of her relationship with the identified partner, that she may have had another partner. So I don't think she can say she lied about it. But what we do know is that the sampling from the crotch area genes, which would have been the intimate area, is a mixture. And if there are only two contributors to that mixture, it excludes the victim. So that does not exclude Mr. Scott from that sample.
Can you develop that point a little more? Because that's a matter of contest under the DNA analysis. So we have a mixture. It's obviously agreed that it does include the defendant in the sperm fraction. And your assertion is that based upon the proper protocols, it would also exclude the victim. Is that right?
Well, that was the finding by DFS, yes.
Okay, explain that in a way that we could understand it.
I'm not sure I can parse through the science. I know that was their conclusion. But because of the occurrence of the different alleles, they were able to develop the model reflected in their notes. It's in our Commonwealth Exhibit B to the motion to dismiss at page 7.
So that going back, I'm sorry, it would take too long for you to do that. We can read it ourselves. So going back to an imaginary trial right now, and you're the prosecutor and she's defense attorney, and she brings the genes in. She says the genes have a sperm fraction. It is not the boyfriend, and it is not my client. And she obviously put it on soon after the rape, and this is where the substance came from. And you stand up and you're the prosecutor and you say, well, that's true. That's factually true. But so what? You should still convict. Why? What would you say?
I would probably say, much like what the prosecutor did say at trial, that they had serological evidence that did not match Mr. Scott. They had other evidence that was consistent with Mr. Scott, but most importantly, they had an identification from the victim, that composite from the victim, which others recognized as being Mr. Scott. She identified him both prior to trial in the photo array and at trial. It was not admissible trial, but it's open to consideration by this court. The burglaries in Reston stopped at the same time he left the state for Ohio.
Counsel, if there was no DNA evidence whatsoever, no biological evidence, is there enough evidence to convict? And if so, walk us through what that evidence is.
Well, there was
her identification, but what corroboration do you have? What further corroboration?
There was no DNA evidence trial, and he was convicted. It was challenged on sufficiency, and he was convictions were affirmed. And
there was no evidence whatsoever of DNA. I won't be able to pronounce the serological evidence. Did none of it come in at the original trial?
The serological evidence came in, but it was argued.
I'm saying if that was just simply completely off the table.
Yes. Well,
what is the just give a listing of what the evidence is that is sufficient to convict?
The principal evidence is her identification of him as the rapist.
Yes.
And I would point out that the serological evidence, while admitted, was to no trier of fact of any weight. It showed in one test he was, in one test he wasn't implicated. So it was a wash, and the Commonwealth argued it was inconclusive and immaterial. They disclosed it simply to disclose the test had been done. So
I withdraw my question.
So your point is the prosecutor took the issue of the genes off the table at the actual trial. They didn't have DNA, but they had serological evidence, and he goes, look, it doesn't prove anything, so don't worry about it. Their point, though, is different. Their point is, no, it didn't prove a whole lot of anything at trial, but it sort of does now. Because they have more information. Now they can positively exclude the defendant. So the question I'm driving at, and she answered it, I'm not sure you've gotten a hold of it yet, is what would you say to a jury if the jury was told the DNA is clearly not his and it's not his boyfriend's? And I can only hypothesize you'd have to say, well, it's someone else's, or it's not even hers. She's not even there. Maybe it's one of her girlfriends wore her. And then you'd have to come up with some factual statement as to how that could be possibly true. Is that right, or do you have a better argument?
There are two DNA samples that we've been talking about in the briefing. There's the sample from the exterior sample, the green, and the sample from the crotch. And the sample from the exterior is the one she's described as this morning as exonerating him. They had relied on the crotch in some of their briefing. But both, I presume, in the hypothetical, would be before the jury. And while the exterior stain taken alone it is not matched to him, the interior sample, if it's under a hypothetical or an interpretation where there are sufficient contributors that the victim is included, does not exclude him. So I would argue that taking the two DNA tests together and the only interpretation that includes the victim, he is not excluded in that, that is excluded from one DNA sample and not the other, is a factor for them to consider but doesn't render him innocent.
Or in a nutshell, it's just not conclusive, is what you're saying to the jury in this hypothetical trial.
Yes.
Why is it not conclusive?
Say, because we had the two DNA samples, I presume both.
What's the second DNA sample you're talking about?
From the crotch of the jeans. The one that is a mixture of at least two, possibly more contributors.
And he's excluded from that?
He's excluded from that if there are only two contributors.
The perpetrator? I thought a perpetrator is excluded no matter how many contributors there are.
If there are three contributors, is the only way the victim's included.
Correct.
Which means that there's at least one sperm sample in that sample that's not from the rapist.
No, I don't think that's correct. I think there's only one sperm fraction, but there's other DNA.
There's only
non-sperm DNA. And if you consider there are three contributors, then one may have been the victim, and the third person you'd have to explain, and their explanation is that it was probably the person who took the swatch out to do the test on. What would be your position as to who that third person might have been?
My explanation would be the third person means that the other DNA sample doesn't necessarily mean to be the rapist. It could be the same as that. It's a partial mixture. We can't make a definite exclusion either way. I also would argue that there, and this proceeding, not free to speculate that there was contamination or not. The burden's on them to establish beyond, to clear and convincing evidence. And if they have to speculate that there was contamination or one of the other theories that there was not, that's not enough for them.
Do we know anything about DFS protocols at the time as to what, you know, because back then the name of the game was serological evidence, not DNA evidence. Were they wearing gloves, that kind of thing? Is there any information one way or the other?
I personally don't know, and I'm not aware of anything in the record.
Because I know, like, at least in modern testing, there's all these elaborate protocols about just about every aspect of forensic testing so that when it's challenged, they can meticulously refute any possibility of contamination. I mean, like the unique record number, the logging in of it, the tracking of it throughout the building, I mean, everything. I just didn't know if at the time there was anything comparable vis-a-vis wearing of gloves, not gloves, whatever.
I can only presume they would have taken whatever protocols appropriate to protect this.
The bottom line is we don't know, right, on this record.
It's not on the record that I'm aware of.
All right.
I would like to take a moment to address the Diamond case that's been argued was significantly similar to the case. In the Diamond, the clothing that was at issue in that case, evidence showed, was the same clothing that the victim had worn during the assault. It had also was a case where Diamond rejected a photograph of Mr. Diamond, gave some details about his features were different. In this case, the victim picked Scott's photo out of the array. In this case, also, the victim's initial physical description was consistent. In Diamond, it was inconsistent with Mr. Diamond. So I think we've detailed that at pages 18 and 19 of our motion to dismiss. There are significant differences, we contend, with Diamond. This is not that case. The final argument that's made in their pleadings is that her identification is a suspect. I just raised that those arguments also were made at trial. In closing, they argued that there was no light on, that she was only shown the pictures several months later. They questioned whether the composite, in fact, looked like Scott. They argued that she didn't get a good look at him, that she was under stress, and the human memories failed. The jury at the time was not persuaded by those arguments, and we submit that those do not cast doubt on her identification in this case. Significantly compared to many cases, this in the court of appeals scene, there is no recantation or even partial retreat from her identification of Mr. Scott.
I'm sorry to ask this question, but assume for the sake of argument that the most reasonable interpretation of DNA testing is that the defendant can be excluded as a contributor. Just assume for the sake of argument. If that assumption were made, what is the Commonwealth's hypothesized explanation for who the other male contributor would have been other than the rapist?
The best hypothesis is her uncertainty whether, depending on the stage of her relationship with the named boyfriend, whether there was another partner.
So another boyfriend. Now, as you can tell from our recent cases, the Commonwealth has an opportunity to amplify the record in an actual innocence case, and she could come in with an affidavit that says exactly that. I didn't want to say this years ago. I was ashamed, but I was actually having relations with other men, actually within a short period of time. But nothing like that apparently appears in this record. Am I right?
The only thing like that that appears in this record is the record of her interview with Detective Horn in 2017, where she's uncertain what stage her relation was with the named partner, and thinks, depending on the stage, it was possible there was another person.
But isn't there evidence that closer to time, the boyfriend was the only partner?
That was the only one that was
right. So I mean, now we're fast forwarding. I mean, wouldn't it be typically we place more weight on more contemporaneous recollection versus, you know, decades after the fact. So does that affect our thinking on that point?
I see my time expired and I believe to answer.
Absolutely.
That is a consideration that goes to the weight. But in the hypothetical, how I would explain it to the jury, that's the most obvious.
But their argument is also that if that were true, there would have been a mixture. Let's assume there was another boyfriend, another intimate partner. Their argument is there would have been a mixture of that person with the rapist and there was only a single profile. So another intimate partner would not explain their side of the argument, would it?
It would if we return to the question of whether these were the genes that were involved at the time of the rape. If there were another intimate partner and the sample is accounted for by that, and the genes do not reflect any evidence of the rapist, then it's inconclusive because it's not probative of what did or didn't happen on the night of the rape.
All right. Thank you very much. Your time has expired. Rebuttal?
Thank you.
Your Honors, I hope I can make my many points in the 3 minutes that I have left. But to start with, these are the genes. They are the correct genes. The survivor and the detective, Detective Wilkins, have the same interest at the moment when she calls the police, and the police arrive at her house, and that interest is to catch her rapist. She's not going to give the wrong genes, and it's unreasonable to suppose that she would deliberately give the wrong genes or accidentally give the wrong genes, or that Wilkins would collect them. Moreover, just to be clear, we're talking about...
Didn't she say to the investigator that she had destroyed... Oh, yeah. That she had destroyed much of the evidence by the time the officer arrived, or before the officer arrived?
Well, that I think, is in reference to the fact that she washed. But she put the jeans on before she washed. She put the jeans on before she left the bedroom. And she's very clear today that she never would have left the bedroom without having put something on. I'd also like to say that there's three, just because there seems to be some confusion, there are three items of evidence, two cuttings from jeans, A and B, and cuttings from vaginal swabs. Each of these three pieces of evidence alone exonerates Mr. Scott, and together they form uncontroversial and mutually reinforcing proof that Mr. Scott is innocent. And there's no scientific reason to prefer the Commonwealth's assumption that there were only two individuals in genes cutting A as opposed to three. Now, all of the sperm in each of these pieces of evidence was a clean, single person. And the only issue that we're talking about, a mixture, is the non-sperm fraction of cuttings A. Now, DFS itself didn't make that assumption that there were only two people, and DFS's conclusion is not that there are only two people, and there's no scientific reason to conclude that. On the October 24th, 2017, which was at Commonwealth's Exhibit B, DFS says DNA types attributable to JD are present in the sample at three loci. So DFS itself is not preferring a conclusion that would exclude the survivor.
I'm confused. I'm looking at the Commonwealth's brief, and as I read their brief, they're saying that the one that contained the mixture was a sperm fraction. You're saying that...
The sperm fractions were not a mixture. The sperm fractions were clean, single-source profiles. The court asked, is this a sufficient? Is there sufficient evidence to convict? This standard on the writ after the change to would from could is no longer a sufficiency of evidence test, and the court affirmed that in Watford, and that it's a probabilistic determination of what a rational jury would do when all of the evidence is weighed and they're properly instructed.
Do you know anything about DFS protocols prior to, you know, in other words, because your hypothesis is perhaps a Ms. Burton, you know, in handling this, and that's the source, or I suppose a police officer in bagging it or something. But do we know anything about whether they would have worn gloves or anything like that?
We don't know anything specifically, but the court in Brown itself suggested that part of the problem with the profile from the non-sperm fraction was that this was a pre-DNA world, and people were touching items. And that was an intimate sample on a slide. This is genes, and you have to spread the genes out in order to look at them, and you have to hold them when you're cutting them, and this is a pre-DNA world. There's nobody we've spoken to has said that anybody wore gloves at the time, and DFS could not confirm that they wore gloves at the time.
All right, your time has expired. Thank you for your argument.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Call the next case.